Matt?
Yes.
Good. That's good. I can hear you. So I guess what we're going to do is we're probably going to hang up and call you back in about 6 minutes.
Okay.
Or 8 minutes, actually, because I need to do my intro. And I've just got your book, and I'm just, what I want you to do, I'll ask you to tell the story of the Range Cafe, how you got started, and I'll probably pop some questions in there, nothing you can't answer, and I think that you and I are going to talk for about, from like 5:07 to about 5:20, and then I'll give people resources where they can buy the book, and to make sure they visit your three locations. Should we talk about Standard Diner 2 or not?
Only if you want to bring it up, sure.
Okay. And just be sure to speak up or speak a little louder so that I can hear you, because your voice is really soft right now.
Yeah, and I can't hear you.
You can't
well
hear me either?
But, yeah, so.
Okay, so I should tell Nat that, too.
Yeah. I mean, I can hear you okay. I've got the office door closed now. It's a little better.
Right, but it's probably as soft as, and I'm speaking pretty clearly and loudly, so.
Okay, I'll be sure to speak louder.
Okay, into the mouthpiece.
Right.
That's important. People, I always interview people and I see them, they're like not even talking into the microphone, they're all
right.
Over the place, so. All right, well let's, these guys are probably going to get you back on the line in about 6 or 7 minutes.
Okay.
All right,
and,
good, thanks. Okay.
As far as a history of the range, how far in detail do you want me to go?
Well, just for you, we've got about 15 minutes. So, I mean, I'm really interested in, I love the fact that you and Matt, it doesn't sound like you guys knew each other really well.
Not really, no.
Okay, so I think that's interesting. You both came here to do different things. So we want to talk a little bit about that. And then finding your spot and the fire. Because I think that's big, and I think the fact that you, in a pretty short time, you know, you had been able to cultivate a following of people that really wanted. Manchester, publisher of Edible Santa Fe and member of Edible Communities, and you're listening to Edible Communities Show on the Heritage Radio Network. And today we'd like to thank our sponsor, Hearst Ranch. I know I say it every time, but I'm going to say it again. And Edible Communities, Inc. Creates editorially rich, community-based local foods publications in distinct culinary regions throughout the U.S. and Canada. And we connect consumers with family farmers, growers, chefs, and food artisans of all kinds, and believe that every person has the right to affordable, fresh, healthful food on a daily basis. We are a for-profit, member-driven corp, individuals who own our own publications. They are local foods advocates and residents of the communities they publish in, a business model that not only supports our values but also preserves the integrity of our member publications in the communities we serve. And we've got a really good show today. I've got two very interesting guests. One is Matt DeGregory, and Matt and his business partner Tom Fenton are co-authors of a new book called Home on the Range Cookbook. And they actually have several restaurants here in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And our next guest is Woody Cash. And Woody Cash has just written a book called Slow Money. He's the chairman emeritus of Investors Circle, a nonprofit of angel, a network of angel investors and venture capitalists, foundations, and family offices that since 1992 has facilitated the flow of $130 million to 200 early stage companies and venture funds dedicated to sustainability. He is the president of the newly formed NGO called Slow Money. He's the former treasurer of the Jesse Smith Noyes Foundation. He's an experienced venture capital investor and entrepreneur, and he's served on numerous for-profit and nonprofit boards. So that should be a really interesting show today, and we hope that you'll stick with us and come on back in a few minutes. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with Matt DeGregory.
Late at night, when you're half asleep, and you pray the Lord your soul to keep, won't always be nice dreams, though some will be, you'll dream of me.
So welcome back to the Edible Community Show on Heritage Radio Network, and we're back with Matt DeGregory of the Range Cafe here in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and co-author of Home on the Range. Welcome, Matt.
Hi, Kate. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. So I was really fascinated with your story, and we did an excerpt of the book in our summer issue of Edible Santa Fe. And one of the things that really struck me, first of all, you guys are very successful restaurateurs, which is no small feat in itself, but you are also two gentlemen that came into this from very different places, and it sounds to me like you didn't really intend to start a restaurant. How did that happen? What were you doing in Albuquerque, and how did you and Tom get started?
Well, it's always funny because my very first job at 15 years old was as a dishwasher. I swore I would never work in another restaurant again as long as I lived. But it just so happened that I had some family that was in New Mexico, and I was going to film school in Los Angeles. And I just got to the point where I couldn't stand L.A. anymore, and every time I came to New Mexico, I really loved everything about New Mexico. I have a family history here. My parents lived in New Mexico in the early 40s and late early 50s, I should say. So we've always kind of come back out here, and I knew that I would end up here one day. And it just so happened that my older brother started a fine dining restaurant called the Prairie Star, which was located in Bernalillo, New Mexico. And I knew that if I moved to New Mexico, I could get a job in his restaurant as a waiter. And that's exactly what I did. The opportunity came about. I became a waiter, and I started working in the restaurant. And I slowly started to realize that I really enjoyed it and that I had a lot of good ideas that I thought would work. And that's kind of when, after working for him for 6 years, I decided that, hey, you know, I should take a stab at this. And I found a little building in Bernalillo, and everything just sort of fell into place, and it worked out really well.
And how did you, you started working with Tom Fenton. Is he still your partner, your business partner?
He is, in the Range Cafe, definitely. And at one point in time, I kind of felt this need to kind of expand myself and find out what other restaurants were about. And I went to work for what was at the time and still is one of Albuquerque's best restaurants called Scallo. Scallo was the first restaurant in Albuquerque area to kind of really buck the trend and start. They were doing kind of big city food, and I went to work for them as a pastry chef. And Tom was working there at the time, and he wanted a job a little closer to home, and I said, hey, you should go work out at Prairie Star. So he was working at Prairie Star as a line cook, and that's kind of when I started really getting this idea of kind of a small town cafe type restaurant setting that did really good quality food. And I found a little building, and the rent was $500 a month, and it was a really cool building. I used to eat breakfast in this place every day. And when I heard that the building was going to be available, I walked into the rain or into the Prairie Star one day, and I said to a friend of mine, I said, hey, I think I found the building for this restaurant. The only problem is I don't have any money. And Tom kind of overheard me and said, well, I can get some money. And I said, well, you want to be my business partner? And so we kind of shook on it right there, and it's been the range ever since. We're now in our 17th year of business.
Wait, again, no small feat for two guys who actually came here to do something else, or at least started out doing something else. Now, one of the things that happened, and this is where I think the story gets really interesting, is that you pretty quickly created a following, and anybody that's lived in New Mexico knows that this is not so easy to do, particularly amongst locals. You know, you guys are technically out-of-towners. You come to town, you start this restaurant, and you suddenly have, you know, all the neighbors, all the people in the neighborhood, all the locals coming to your restaurant. What was it about that place? I mean, what did you create there that attracted, you know,
I think
attracted
we were kind
people?
Of, it was one of those right place, right time situations. Bernalillo is this cool little town, and it has rich, deep cultural history. But what's kind of happening to Bernalillo is that areas around it have started to develop and grow and become gentrified, so to speak. And there wasn't any place doing anything creative. And there were a couple really great Mexican restaurants in town. There were a couple of fast food restaurants in town. But there was nothing that was sort of covering the other bases. And I used to eat at this place in Los Angeles called the Local Yoke, which is a great little breakfast lunch place. And it just had really good food, really good quality, really good portions, and it was fairly inexpensive. And I was craving sort of that same thing, is sort of create this good atmosphere. And we were able to start this place for, I don't know, it was like $15,000. It was just incredible that we could start it that inexpensively. We bought cheap chairs from a first cafeteria that had wheels on them, and they'd roll across the floor. And, you know, it was just really lucky. And it was amazing that we spent a couple of months remodeling the interior. And as we were doing that, people started talking about it. It's like, oh, my God, there's going to be a real restaurant in the town of Bernalillo that wasn't just Mexican food. And so the word started getting out, and a buzz started creating all by itself because people were wanting it and needing it. And the day that we opened, we had planned to do breakfast, lunch, and dinner right from the very get-go. And we opened the doors at 7:30 in the morning, and we were so overwhelmed with people that we ran out of food at 2 o'clock, and we had to shut the doors and go, oh, my
wow.
God, what just happened? We served, I don't know, it was somewhere around 275 people on our very
wow.
first day in business, and a place that only seats 56 people. So it was right from the very start, we were busy and packed and crowded, and it just kind of took off from there and always stayed that way.
So tell us what happened with the fire.
The fire, you know, it was one of the most bizarre things that happened, and I think there were some different powers that be that kind of oversaw us on that. We started talking about expanding the little building that we were in. Like I said, it only sat 56 people. We at times would have 70 and 80 people waiting out the door to get in the place to eat, so we knew we needed more space. But we couldn't really add on to it. But we decided, well, we love this building. We'll figure something out. We need to remodel. So we started putting in upgraded systems. We, you know, changed the wiring. We changed the plumbing. We put in new floors. We redid the bathrooms. Everything was sort of happening. And 2 weeks after we finished that remodel, we put in a new alarm system. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, I got a phone call that all the alarm systems were going off. And I said, well, you know, they just put a new alarm system in today. It's got to be a mistake. And about 10 minutes later, after I had canceled the call, I got a frantic call from the police department saying, you have flames shooting out of your building.
Oh, my gosh.
So still thinking that it was just a minor thing, I threw the dog in the car and ran down the hill from where I lived. And as I'm driving down from up in the mountains, I could see this cloud of smoke over the town of Bernalillo, and I thought, oh, my God, this is a big deal. So I get down there, and it didn't take me long to realize that the restaurant was gone. You know, this was way more than a small fire. And immediately the next morning, by 7 o'clock in the morning, the fire trucks were still there. People started showing up, you know, to come and have breakfast or come and have lunch. And word just sort of got around that, oh, my God, our sort of home base in the town of Bernalillo was gone. And we were kind of in awe, not knowing what we were going to do. We were way underinsured, as you find out in these situations,
right,
much too
right.
late. And we were sort of in limbo for 2 months. When some of the customers started talking, it's like, hey, we need to motivate these guys to come back. You know, we need to get them to stay in Bernalillo. And we had tons of offers to kind of go on the main highway in Bernalillo amongst all the fast food restaurants. And we decided that really wasn't the spot for us. Our home was in the downtown area, this little bitty town. And they threw a fundraiser for us. And it was amazing. It was a movable feast between 3 bed and breakfasts. They had, you know, appetizers and music at one location and main entree and music at another location, dessert and an art auction at another location. And the end result was they raised $10,000 to rebuild the range.
Wow.
And that wasn't nearly enough to do it, but it did motivate us to the point to say, hey, you know, this is more than just a business here. This is kind of a community involvement. And it motivated us to go on. And we were fortunate that a woman named Marianne Bessem, who had a business in town where she had a kind of an event space that had a kitchen in it. And she said, hey, you guys can set up here and run your restaurant Monday through Friday. And weekends, you know, you got to kind of get out of the way so she can do her wedding business. And that's what we did. We ran that for a year until we found our current home, which we've been in for the last, 13 or 14 years.
Hmm. So I guess I think it's really extraordinary that you had this community rally around you. Again, we're talking at that time, it was not a big town, really. But how many restaurants do you know that have that kind of impact on a community where they rally around you and say, hey, you have to come back and we're going to help you do it?
You know, it was pretty extraordinary, and still talking about it today, you know, gets me choked up a little bit because it was so special. I mean, it was literally the community coming together to help some people who were there trying to help the community to begin with. You know, we've always been very pro helping out local people. You know, artists in town have always displayed their works in our restaurant. We've used them now to kind of help decorate all of our current restaurants that we now have. So it's definitely been a community thing. You know, all the people who work there were members of the community, and, you know, they've grown up and they now have kids who work at the restaurant. So it's always been very much of a community-type situation. We've always tried to support the locals, support people who are in business to help support us. And, you know, it's kind of what comes around goes around. And,
absolutely.
It came back around for us, fortunately.
So, Matt, you said that you were, first of all, I just want to let people know that the book is absolutely gorgeous. And that was the thing that really caught my eye, is the colors. I believe Eric Swanson is the photographer. And just the photography is fantastic. If you like New Mexican food and, you know, lots of people come here just for the food, you should definitely get a copy of this for a loved one. You can get it at www.rangecafe.com. And if you add a /shop to that, it'll take you right to the place where you can buy the book. But the book is absolutely gorgeous. Matt, do you have plans? I mean, do you think it'll be on Amazon soon or at least?
You know, I think it's a possibility. I mean, we're new at this. We're not book publishers. We're restaurant people. And,
right.
You know, fortunately, Maria Levy and Eric Swanson came to us a while back and said, hey, we think we could do a really nice cookbook for you. And they really did. I mean, they're two of the nicest people. And they've been so easy to deal with, and they did produce us an incredibly beautiful book. I mean, the photographs, as you said, are great. Eric just did such a wonderful job. We could not be happier with how it turned out. You know, they've done some cookbooks for some other people that have kind of gone that next step where they got some national recognition. You know, we're not planning that to happen. If it does, yeah, then we're going to have to look at probably, you know, who knows? Will it show up at Costco one day or Borders? Amazon's probably the first step with that. anything's possible. You know, we've always been kind of people who put it out to the universe, and the universe takes care of ourselves. So,
I would say the universe is taking really good care of you guys. So
yeah.
You must have done something. You know, this just doesn't happen. It really just doesn't. You know, you've obviously created a lot of people that care about you, and you've given back to your community, and now they're giving back to you.
So.
You started out as a pastry chef. Tell me some of your favorite recipes. The book is full of delicious recipes. You've got, your world-famous meatloaf in there. What else have you got in there? You've got, will you tell us what's in the book?
Well, it covers basically all the favorites of the range, you know, chicken fried steak or green chili or red chili or salsas. There's over 100 recipes, and some of it is stuff that we just like to cook at home, some items that have never made it into the restaurant for various reasons, things that I've been making since I was a little kid. You know, I became a pastry chef totally by accident. I was working at my brother's restaurant, and the pastry chef went on vacation one day, and I said, well, I'll fill in. I don't know anything about it, but I can read a recipe and make stuff. And they liked what I did so much that they got rid of that guy, and I became the pastry chef. So... my favorites are sort of things that aren't terribly complicated, but have some nice mixtures of ingredients and layers of flavors that make for really nice desserts. I don't like stuff that's really sickeningly sweet or has fake food coloring in it. It's always good quality ingredients, butter, real fruit, that kind of stuff.
That's also true of everything that's made in the restaurant. I mean, you guys pretty much from scratch joint.
Absolutely. Yeah, we try not to cut corners. We always say ordinary food made extraordinarily well. It's how you would want to make it at home. I look at a recipe, if it has, if it's got gelatin in it, I don't like to put it in it because I look at that
right.
And say, ooh, that's not something I'd want to eat on its own. You know, I
right.
pay attention to what's going in the food. You know, we don't use dyed yellow cheese, other than I'll have to admit our queso does have Velveeta in it because queso needs to have Velveeta
queso
in it.
Queso needs to have Velveeta, folks. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those ones people freak out and go, oh, my God, I can't believe you use Velveeta, but it's chili
on queso. Yeah, but they
queso,
eat it, it's delicious, and if you hadn't told them,
really
that's what they're
good,
eating,
so.
By the way. That's what you're eating if you're eating queso. So, so Matt, I really want to thank you, first of all, for the beautiful book and doing all that you do for the community in Albuquerque. And let's tell everybody your three locations in your website, just in case we get some travelers coming to New Mexico. I think visiting the Range Cafe is well worth it. You won't leave disappointed, I promise you.
All of our locations are listed on the website, which is rangecafe.com. We have our original location, which is in the great little town of Bernalillo. If you're landing in Albuquerque and going to Santa Fe, it's a great way to stop and see some New Mexico culture. We have two other locations in the town of Albuquerque, one up in the Northeast Heights and one near the university area. And then I also have the Standard Diner, which is located downtown. And we have a new project on the horizon called Rodeo Grill, which is going to be in one of our old locations. So,
fantastic!
Lots of different styles of food, and you'll find something to eat somewhere.
All good
at
food
any one
too.
Of them.
So I encourage you to visit therangecafe.com. Order a book. It's absolutely gorgeous. As I said, you won't be disappointed. If you're up in Santa Fe, Matt's going to be here with us up at the Santa Fe Farmers Market signing books. We're not quite sure the date, but we'll keep you posted on Edible Santa Fe. And next week on Edible Santa Fe, the excerpt of Matt's book should be on the web. Matt, thanks for joining us today.
Kate, I appreciate it. Happy cooking.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back with Woody Tash.
Never would lie to each other. The choices you've made have driven me away, and I never wanna see you again. I'm still trying to find my way, and you're not helping now. Is to give you away. So I give you away to win my love. I give you away.
lots of land and the starry skies above. Don't fence me in, let me ride through the wide open country that I love. Don't fence me in, let me be by myself in the evening breeze. Listen to the murmur of the cottonwood trees. Send me off forever, but I ask you please, don't fence me in. Don't fence me in. Just turn me loose, let me straddle my old saddle underneath the western skies. On my guides, let me wander over yonder till I see the mountains rise. I want to ride to the ridge where the west commences. Gaze
until I lose my senses. You can't hear it? This is Kate Manchester, and we're back. You're listening to Edible Communities Radio and the Heritage Radio Network. And I'm back with my guest, Woody Tash. We are talking about inquiries into the nature of slow money. This is Woody's new book, Investing as if Food, Farms, and Fertility Mattered. This book investigates an essential new strategy for investing in local food systems and introduces a group of fiduciary activists who are exploring what should come after industrial finance and industrial agriculture. Theirs is a vision for investing that puts soil fertility into return on investment calculations. Welcome, Woody Tash.
Great to be here.
So you've been involved in SRIs for a long time. How did your involvement evolve into this idea of slow money? And, you know, obviously I'm thinking that you're influenced by slow food, right?
Slow food was the most recent influence. So if we just tell a very short version of the story, it starts in the 70s with E.F. Schumacher and then leaps ahead to this last decade with slow food. And I've been in and around investing in early-stage organic food businesses for a long time, and it's been obvious for quite a while that we're really not organized to do what's needed on the ground. We're still acting as if, let's say, global markets are the definer of all things commercial, and it's time to try to design a system that really works closer to the ground.
Mm-hmm. That brings us to my next question about the difference in the concept of the markets down versus markets up, and the limitations of the markets down model and how this relates to the food sector.
Right. I think what you meant was markets down versus the ground up.
Ground up.
Which,
yes.
Which by the way, is the name of our conference in Santa Fe, September 9th through 11th. But, the idea is very basic. All of these ideas are, in essence, very simple. The only thing what's gotten complicated is the world in which they need to be put to work. So the idea that if you want to invest in food, you should design that system from the ground up rather than markets down. If you're working with markets, you know, let's say the smallest thing you can figure out how to do is maybe Stonyfield, which is a $400 million, you know, organic yogurt maker. But if you're going from the ground up, you might be delighted to work at the level of the Butterworks Farm. I just use this as an example, which is a 35-year-old independent $1 million yogurt maker in Vermont. And what's cool about this, it's one family, one 300-acre farm, one herd of 60 cows. They grow their own feed and make as much yogurt as they can make from that one farm, which happens to be $1 million worth of yogurt, which, if there are any farmers out there listening, is a pretty phenomenal success for a farm-based enterprise. But from a markets-down perspective, it doesn't even exist. $1 million 30-year-old business, you will not find a financier on the planet who's trained traditionally, who will want to deal with that. It's just not big enough, and it's not scalable, and yada, yada, yada. So I think it's you know, very obvious to anyone who knows what's going on the ground that we need to design, you know, as we said, from the ground up, not from markets down.
So is part of the point of writing this book and starting this...
you can say it, movement.
Movement. Movement. Is part of that, I know that part of it is to educate investors, to get them interested in investing in exactly that, in farms like that. I mean, any takers?
Well, we're about to prove that there are. Let's put it that way. We're building a network of investors and entrepreneurs and donors. You know, it's a broad network. It's not just investors, but it has a bunch of investors in it. Let's say scores of them at the moment.
And these are people with lots of national experience investing in organics and whatnot. But our goal, and I would like to say within about a year we will know if we're going to achieve this goal, is to organize tens of thousands of investors and communities all around the United States to, let's say, have the gumption, if I can put it that way, to take a portion of their assets and invest them in local food systems. Now, we're going to try to make it as easy as we can for them, so we're not going to rely on everyone to have enormous individual gumption. I could say more about that if you want, but
Please do.
Well, there are a couple of pieces to it, but to the first part of what you said, yes, we're inspiring investors to do what they actually know in their heart is right, which is if we keep sending all of our money up smokestacks in China, we're going to keep getting what we have. And the trick is that it isn't easy. In other words, so people can have that realization but still not do anything, because what do? They have to find some farm down the street to invest in. That's a pretty hard thing for an individual investor to do. So we're starting with vision, which is not unimportant. I have to say that. I'm not embarrassed. I'm 58, so I get to say some things that I feel like I've learned over the last 35 years or so. We have to be willing to stay for a while at the level of vision, meaning articulate a real alternative vision of finance. And that's what we are doing right now, and that is attracting. We now have, I think we're up to about 150 people who are members of the Slow Money Alliance, of whom 80 or so are founding members, meaning people who have put in $1,000 or more dollars. So these are people who are looking for alternatives for their money. And that vision will then get us to a scale where we can then begin working in various local communities. We'll probably start in 4 to 6 communities next year, actually working on the ground with groups of investors to help them do it. But before we get to the doing of it, we have to, get to scale with the vision. And that's what we're doing that over the Internet right now. I am traveling around the country talking, doing some of it's a little bit like a regular book tour. Others, we're actually organizing what we call Slow Money Institute's one-day workshops. We have one coming up in Madison at the end of July. And these are sessions where we have farmers, entrepreneurs, donors, investors in a region talking about what a healthy local food system would look like a generation from now, and what the capital kind of needs would be. And I would say the combination of these activities, the convenings, the education, the inspiration, the book, and then in the course of the next 6 to 12 months, actually coming to market with structures that will make it easier for groups of investors to do this, I think, a year or so from now, people will see that this is happening.
Just for the record, you can find out more at www.slowmoneyalliance.org. And I guess one of the things, again, you came from Investor Circle. I've already sort of given folks a little bit of intro about what you did there and what Investor Circle is all about. What was it that inspired you to start thinking about Slow Money, and where did that come from? Where did the seeds of this come from?
Well, again, that's probably not an invitation to tell my whole life story, but and don't worry, everybody out there, I won't. I'd say it's a confluence of things. The events of the last few decades, let's say, have led us to a certain precipice, if we want to call it that, or a certain place of deep uncertainty. Maybe that's a better way to put it. No one's really sure what's going on out in the global economy anymore, not even the, quote, experts, unquote. And, people like Joseph Stiglitz, who's, Nobel Prize-winning economist and, very well-respected voice, is saying things like, we're not fixing the structural problems of the economy because we don't know what they are. And, there are a million expressions that explain where we are, like insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, hoping for a different outcome, or to a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And that's what macroeconomics is. We just keep looking for the same fixes. We've got to put more credit. We've got to keep growing. We've got to get people to buy more cars. We've got to somehow, prop things up with more liquidity. So I don't know about all that because I'm not a macroeconomist. But I do feel in my bones that we have not addressed the structural problems. And the structural problems are deep and they're a little scary. I mean, we are at the end of a pendulum of globalization and consumerism and industrialization that's been kind of, let's say, swinging for a couple of hundred years, if you want to say that, since the Industrial Revolution, and is now at an extreme. And the pendulum is going to come back. I don't think there's any question. The only question is whether it'll come back with a lot of disruption and pain and suffering. So if you think about things like water use, if we get to agriculture and we'll be a little more specific, we talk about water use or biodiversity or soil erosion or nutrition or toxics in the food chain, all of these things that basically happened because after World War II, we just kind of did what we knew how to do, which was start processing and putting chemicals on things, and it didn't seem like a bad thing at the beginning. No one knew anything different. So now that we know all of these things, you ask me how I got to this. I guess I'd say just a confluence of my own journey through venture capital and foundation treasurership and all these other things. At the same time, what was going on in the macro world, these things kind of collided in this necessity for coming up with some structural changes. And I do want to return to your reference to slow food, because while in the U.S. slow food is still relatively small, let's say, and hasn't become a major cultural force, certainly in Europe, obviously in Italy, but in many countries, it has a much deeper, more political, more cultural, more transformative piece to it, and it certainly has influenced me a lot. I mean, if anybody's listening who has been to a Terra Madre meeting in Italy where 5,000 farmers from 150 countries come together, it is mind-boggling how beautiful it is. And it's so I think all these things come together, and they just impel one, if you really want to try to solve the structural problems, not to just keep doing the same thing over and over again, but say, wait a minute, let's stop. We're not talking about throwing globalization out. We're talking about being willing to take more than maybe 0.1% of our assets, which is about what the numbers indicate right now, 0.1% going to sustainable agriculture or organics or whatever you want to measure. It's, obviously, that's not enough. So we have to start designing systems that will allow 1%, 2%, 5%, or God forbid, 10 or 20% of our assets to flow in a fundamentally different way.
I also think that, again, you know, what you said about slow food and its impact in other European and other countries, we don't feel the impact here in America, because we can go to the supermarket and we can buy whatever we need to buy whenever we need it. But I think that that's an important, I think we probably don't have time to talk about all of agriculture, but I did want to talk a little bit about peak soil. In your book, you have a quote by David Montgomery, who's a professor of earth and space sciences at the University of Washington, and he stated that societies that deplete natural stocks of critical renewable resources like soil sow the seeds of their own destruction. So I wanted to just make the connection here for people about what that means and its relationship to our ecology and food supply.
Well, what's amazing to me is, you know, that I would say as a society, I'll just take America here for a second, as a culture, I think we would all say the vast majority of Americans now recognize that climate change is something. It's no longer a hoax. It's no longer just a bunch of environmentalists making trouble.
So it's real. Right.
So something's happening. We can disagree about the pace of it. We can disagree even about some of the causes or about how severe it's going to be, but it is a real thing. So that's pretty big and ponderable. That's the first time I would say real global limits have imposed themselves on our consciousness. And what's interesting to me is how little attention is really on soil fertility, which is just as important to our survival. People may think I'm making these numbers up, but I promise I'm not. These are widely accepted numbers internationally. Between 0.5% and 1% per annum of arable soil, meaning, you know, soil that has fertility that can be cultivated, is being lost to soil erosion every year around the globe. 0.5% to 1% a year. So think about how many years you have before you lose it all. And we're not starting from 100%. We're starting from some depleted thing.
Right.
So there's a huge crisis in soil fertility. Once you start thinking about soil fertility and you get into it a little bit, it appalls you to think about the fact that industrial agriculture is basically doing everything backwards. We destroy soil organic matter, we overplow, we dump toxic chemicals on, we do everything we can to boost. It's like using steroids. To me, it's an exact metaphor. We recognize that steroids boost performance for a short period of time and then destroy the body. We're doing exactly the same thing with soil. We're dumping millions of tons of chemical fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides, etc., in order to boost production for a few decades. That's all we've been doing. This whole thing's only been going on for several decades. And what it's doing is actually destroying the integrity of the organic matter in the soil, leading to erosion, et cetera. So at some point in the next few decades, this is all going to come to roost.
Okay, so let's talk about restorative economics and what does that mean? I mean, at some point in the second part of the book, because it's hugely depressing.
Wait a minute. The book isn't depressing.
Well,
don't say that.
I think that what we've done is depressing, and the fact that we've all been pretty much asleep at the wheel and asleep to it. And as I said, you know, most you know, the average American is not aware of the impact of, you know, the choices that they're making in the supermarket. And before we talk about restorative economics, that was another point. You had another quote in there by the poet Gary Schneider, and he said, "Food is the field in which we daily explore our harming of the world." And you state, Woody, that it's also the field in which we explore the boundaries between investing and philanthropy. And I thought that was a really beautiful idea. If people can start to connect a little bit and make the connection between where they're spending their money, as simple as buying, you know, milk in the supermarket. If they can start to make that connection with everything they do and all the food that goes on the plate, that would really shift things for us.
Yeah, I mean, the first form of investment is how you spend your consumer dollars, so let's not forget that. I mean, every time you spend a consumer dollar, you're voting for or against something, whether you know it or not. So if you're buying, let's say, industrial, ultra-pasteurized industrial milk that's full of bovine growth hormone, you're voting for that system. If you're buying, I'll just use the other extreme, raw milk from a farmer down the street, which everybody can't do, but then you're supporting that farmer. There's so many layers to what you just brought up. I mean, the supermarket. People may be surprised if we could do a quiz and let everyone listening answer. So here's the question. What percentage of the food dollar that is spent by the American family goes to a farmer? What percentage? When you spend a dollar, what percentage of that goes to the farmer? I hope everyone's thinking, tick, 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 what are they thinking? 9 cents. All right?
Wow.
So you get what you vote for. If you vote for commodity, cheaply produced chemical agriculture, you are going to get cheap, shelf-stable food of, let's say, questionable nutritional quality, but a lot of calories, cheap. That's what our food system was designed to do.
Right. It's also destroying the planet.
And it's coming at these long-term costs. So going back to your Gary Snyder quote, I would say, I mentioned in the book, and I really mean it, this may sound a little goofy to people, I think we need to look more to farmers and poets than to economists for our way, because the economists are lost in derivatives and arbitrage and hedge funds. They are lost. We will not get the direction we need from economists, but we will get the direction we need from poets and farmers and small food entrepreneurs. And if that sounds crazy, it's only because we live it in a crazy time.
It's also kind of radical. I think of you as a money guy.
Well,
kind of radical.
I've spent a lot of time, let's say, straddling the line between, if you want to say, philanthropy and investing. And I can tell you it's a great relief to finally, after 30-plus years of doing venture capital and entrepreneurship and being a foundation treasurer and whatnot, to actually be able to say in an integral fashion what I believe and to have it resonate with so many people. And now I'm being personal for a second. It's really been gratifying. People, a lot of very sophisticated financial people, not all to be absolutely sure, but more than a few, know deep down that something is really broken in the system. They know it's not sustainable, but they're kind of trapped. I sometimes describe, let's say, macroeconomics or specialized finance as a telescope that's very good at peering into distant markets and nooks and crannies of cyberspace, whatever. If you take the telescope and put it down at your feet, you can't see anything because it's not designed to see what's going on right at your feet. And that's really almost not a metaphor. It's almost a true statement. So when you actually get people focused on what's going on right under their feet, even sophisticated financiers, they realize, oh, my God, you're right. It's like we're not paying attention to what we need to be paying attention to. So, I'm glad you mentioned the Gary Snyder quote, because to me there is so much guidance there that is, again, so basic, but we have to be not afraid to turn in a much more basic direction. And I want to say again, every time we have a cycle around this, it's not with all of our money. The markets are powerful. The power of entrepreneurship is considerable, and we should respect it and use it. But there's another passage in the book that someone picked up on a blog recently by Tom Miller, who happens to be a board member of Slow Money, who ran program-related investing for the Ford Foundation for a decade, so a very sophisticated financier. And he said, we are not trying to throw capitalism out or punish capitalism. We're trying to complete it. This is about completing capitalism. It's about taking things that capitalism, let's say, practice, let's say, 75% complete doesn't do. The final completion is figuring out how to use the power of entrepreneurship to support local economies and small food enterprises. And we do have to figure that out. If we don't, we're going to be so lopsided. We'll be as lopsided as we've been with the credit, with CDOs and derivatives and mm-hmm. subprime mortgages. That was an excess that came about because of a lack of balance and a lack of completion.
Right. So that said, we're not bashing capitalism. We're not. You talk about the beauty of slow food, anti-globalization. But instead of focusing on the negative, I love, you know, you're talking about pro-heirloom and pro-terroir, and you also talk about restorative economics, and that sounds like that's where, you know, this completion piece is. Would you say
Well, here's the good news. This is why people shouldn't be depressed. Although when you said you were depressed, I just want to say when we do one-day workshops on slow money, we go right into the bad stuff, because if you can't face it, you're never going to fix it. If you can't say what's wrong and admit it, you're never going to fix it. So I'm sure there's an analogy to substance abuse and alcoholism and other things. You have to own your problem before you can solve it.
Absolutely.
So, but then not to get paralyzed in the bed, then you say, well, what the hell are we going to do about it? And the answer is, this is the fun part. There are tens of thousands of small food entrepreneurs all across the United States already doing the right thing. And let's say a much smaller number of investors who are beginning to kind of get the idea, well, we got to help these people. So whether it be people starting CSAs or local processing or slow food restaurants, niche organic brands, you know, it's happening. It's actually happening all across the United States. The one category of, I think this is true, that the one category of farms in the last agricultural census that experienced growth was 10 to 49-acre diversified farms. And I'm pretty darn sure if we actually looked at it, I don't know this, but I'm pretty sure this is true, you have a high percentage of organic growers, and that people who are starting these small diversified farms, a lot of them are going to be organic. So we don't have to get paralyzed in the imponderables. We just need to turn and start celebrating all of this sort of proliferation of small, beautiful entrepreneurship. And when you made the comment anti-globalization, I want to amend that. Carlo Petrini, the founder of Slow Food, uses the phrase virtuous globalization, meaning a form of globalization that supports lots of small producers all over the planet, let's say, doing the right thing for their communities and bioregions. So not the form of globalization that has everyone chasing the next billion-dollar investment and the next, let's say, factory in China.
The next big thing.
The next big thing. This is about lots. The next big thing is lots of small things that are decentralized and diversified. And I think the easiest way for people to just sort of click into the new gear is to think about diversity. So I'm always intrigued by the fact that the professional financiers talk about diversification and sell you all kinds of complicated, oh, this is, you know, not correlated with that, and, you know, derivatives was supposed to be the ultimate in diversification, turned out to be the opposite. Forget diversification. Let's talk about actual diversity, biological, cultural, and economic diversity, which is what we need to survive. And if you think about the soil as the ultimate in diversity, billions of microorganisms in a gram of soil. I mean, think about that. It's hard to imagine. Billions of microorganisms in a gram of soil. Millions of multicelled organisms in a gram of soil. Most of them have not even been cataloged. This is a crazy thing. People estimate, David Suzuki, one of the leading scientists, environmental scientists, estimates that as much like 95% of the organisms in the soil have not even been cataloged yet. You know, Leonardo da Vinci said we know more about the movements of the celestial bodies than we do about the soil under our feet, and that's still true. That was the Renaissance. It's still true. So there's a lot to be celebrated. In other words, yes, there's a lot that's gone wrong, but we're all still here, and now at this moment, there's a kind of a rebirth of small organic agriculture in the United States. And so rather than trying to design a whole system, what we need to do is just start supporting all these little entrepreneurs all over the place and just find a way to let our money support diversity.
Mm-hmm. Vote with your dollars. So let's just give people an example, like what kinds of businesses what could be considered slow money businesses, and some of them are going to be names that we know. You know, Organic Valley.
Well, Organic Valley is an interesting one because it's actually scaled. You get into a whole bunch of interesting discussions. Before I mention companies, because if I mention a bunch of companies, they're going to be all over the place in size. So you started with probably the biggest one I would ever mention, Organic Valley. Many people listening, if they're still listening, it's probably because they're interested in organics and whatnot, and so they probably know the name Organic Valley. They may not know it's a $500 million producer co-op. It's owned by 1,300 individual dairy farmers around the United States. Pretty cool. Well, I have to say, very cool. Now, is that a big company or a small company? That discussion by itself is an interesting $500 million company. In today's world, most community activists and most individual farmers say, wow, that is enormous. That's huge, $500 million company. On Wall Street, a $500 million company barely exists. So, but going down from Organic Valley, that would be at the high end. I already mentioned Butterworks Farm being mm-hmm. one that people
right.
may not have heard of, but there's $1 million. Take a company like High Mowing Organic Seeds, also happens to be in northern Vermont. It's maybe $1.5 million company selling seeds to a few thousand growers around the United States. These are random. Cowgirl Creamery in the Bay Area. They're actually also open now on the East Coast in the Philadelphia area. So an artisan cheesemaker. we think on the restaurant, White Dog Cafe, a kind of an iconic restaurant in Philadelphia that Judy Wicks, many people now know of. She's become a kind of a national leader in the local economies movement from the work. 25 years building a $5 million restaurant. One, she could have franchised it a dozen times. She was approached every year by people who wanted to roll it out, and she had the nerve to say, I want to make my company more beautiful. I don't want to make it bigger. She reinvested everything in the company, in her community. She supported local suppliers, all kinds of crazy things that nobody else ever thought to do with a individual restaurant operation. So there's a whole, you know, a raft of these small businesses, you know, really in every community, in different stages of development. Lots of slow food restaurants kind of popping up around. Very hard to make money in the restaurant business. So this is not an area that, let's say, the faint of heart investor would just kind of randomly flow into, but I think as part of a portfolio for supporting local food systems, it makes all kinds of sense. Let's not forget to mention CSAs. If you look at that as a very tiny, tiny, tiny industry niche, there may be as many as 2,000 CSAs in the United States right now. The vast majority of them are tiny from a business standpoint, meaning 25, 50, 75 members. A very small number of elite ones have gotten to, say, above 1,000 members. So these, you know, these are businesses that are in the 500,000, million, million two scale, dollars I'm talking about now, revenue. Tremendous potential to increase CSAs in the United States. The city of Copenhagen alone has 55,000 families getting food from a CSA type. It's not one CSA, so I want to make that clear, but it's a CSA type distribution where the food gets, a box gets sent to their home once a week, a diversified box of organic produce. So there's 55,000 people in one European city. There's 100,000 people in the entire United States right now getting their food from CSAs. So there is tremendous both need and potential to scale CSAs. So that's what comes to mind initially as types. Oh, local processing, I should mention, another category.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Pretty much every community in the country that begins on the path of rebuilding the local food system immediately stumbles upon the processing thing. Since World War II, our local processing has basically been decimated. Everything's been consolidated. So if you want to get a head of organic cattle, let's say, slaughtered somewhere, you might have to send them 750 miles, if you're lucky, right, to get them slaughtered and then to get them back. It's very complicated and expensive. So the local milk processing, big deal. There was a story, I'm happy to say, on NPR a couple of months ago that I think it was the first time the word movement was used to describe slow money. They were covering a local processor, a local milk producer in upstate New York who was trying to build a processing facility on his farm by raising $800,000, $1,000 at a time from 800 customers of his dairy. He hasn't completed the financing yet, but that idea, the idea of connecting consumers directly to producers, not only but with their purchases but with investments, is something I think you're going to see a lot more of.
Well, that's what slow money is all about. I mean, this is what we're talking about here.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah. Well, if you go back to the slow food analogy, slow food is, let's say, making its living, if I can use that expression, connecting consumers to producers. So it's educating and inspiring consumers to know where their food came from, and then to actually begin to buy it directly from producers. Slow money, in a sense, is taking that one step further, and it's saying, what if we could connect investors to that in which they're investing with that same degree of directness? Think how amazing that would be. What if we happen to be sitting in Santa Fe right now? What if 100 investors in Santa Fe 10 years from now had the same excitement about investing locally that 100 CSA members have about going to the farm to buy their food? They just wake up and they say, you know what? We are going to invest a portion of our assets in Santa Fe because it makes us feel good. There's innate value in it. We know it's critical to the survival of this community, and we don't need a lot of experts explaining to us why it's a bad investment. We're just going to do it. I know that sounds a little goofy, but I'm happy for that goofiness.
I am too, and I'm actually pleased. I'm listening to you talk, and you know, I'm going to give a little plug to Edible Communities because this is a community. This could also be a slow money business because, you know, Edible Communities is made up of 58 communities right now of people that made an investment in a model that's sinking, and we're actually thriving because we've made a choice to provide a resource for our community, for small producers, for small farmers, for CSAs, and that's what we're doing. We're not all profitable, But it's important. It's important work, and people love it. People appreciate it. So that's my plug for Edible Communities, which I don't usually do. But I was just thinking, So we've got a short amount of time left. We've only got about 4 minutes, not nearly enough time. And I wanted to talk a little bit about slow money principles. And I know that on the website, which is slowmoneyalliance.org, people can go and take a look at these slow money principles, and also want to just touch on really briefly the fact that the Slow Money Institute is going to take place here in Santa Fe on September 9th, 10th, and 11th. You can get more information on that at slowmoneyalliance.org.
Yeah, just clarify a quick thing. The institutes are what we've been calling these one-day workshops in different regions. What we're doing in Santa Fe in the fall is our first national gathering, and if anyone's listening and wants to be part of, you know, I don't want to oversell it, but this may be the beginning of the next phase of this activity. We have people coming from Japan and from Italy, probably France. I'm kind of excited to say that the spark has just kind of my book is coming out in Japanese in the fall and in Italy. So this, I think there's a reasonable chance this is going to be a very exciting threshold event at a different scale than the institutes we've been doing. The principles, I'm glad you mentioned it. Basically, just very quickly, this is as much about culture as it is about finance. That's why I'm willing to say things that sound goofy to financiers. This is about, let's say, reasserting the primacy of culture over finance, that finance is supposed to be a tool for supporting culture, not for extracting profits from culture. So a whole lot of things we could talk about there. But the principles are the first organizing tool we're using. So they may not be perfect. They're sure to evolve. There are 12 of them at the moment. I already know we're going to add a couple in the next month or so. People should go on our website, check out the principles, and the first thing we're asking people to do is just sign them if you believe in this direction. No money involved, just be counted, sign the principles. We want to get 50 or 100,000 people to sign the principles by the end of next year. I don't know if that's overly ambitious or not ambitious enough. I hear different things from different people. Why do we want to do that? If we get 50 to 100,000 people to sign the principles, we already know that statistically a percentage of them will also decide to be members of the Slow Money Alliance, which is not necessary to sign. I want to emphasize that. But there's another place you can click if you want to actually chip in a few bucks and be a member of the Slow Money Alliance. It's very gratifying how many people have done that, but that's not a requirement. If we just get 50 to 100,000 people to sign the principles, I am willing to, let's say, hang my hat on the premise publicly that we will be able to leverage that momentum with significant funding from major donors, federal and state programs, et cetera. So why do we want to do that? Because our goal is to get, we are a nonprofit, we're trying to get enough millions of dollars flowing through our vessel, if you will, that we can catalyze this activity in localities around the United States. I've already stated what the ultimate goal is. The goal would be a decade or so from now, hundreds of investors in each community of the United States voluntarily doing this kind of investing. What we're about is demonstrating it, catalyzing it, providing seed capital, and basically getting out of the way. And if you look at it from a species level, if we can say that for a second, sounds a little silly, but it isn't, we're already too late in many, many ways. There's a beautiful, go back to Gary Snyder, there's a beautiful poetic justice that is possible here, and that is that soil rich in organic matter actually is a carbon sink that has the potential to remediate global warming. I know this sounds totally bombastic, and it is a little. But if you could just wave a wand and imagine every acre of farmland in the world going deep organic and building organic matter in the soil, we actually could reverse global warming. Now, I'm not sitting here telling you that that's going to happen, but I would say that the goal of starting to build organic matter in our soil acre by acre is analogous to starting to rebuild the social capital in our communities, let's say deal by deal, and let's get going in the right direction. The fact that it's a little bit daunting on a macro, let's not worry about that. Let's just start doing it, you know, 1 acre at a time, one small food enterprise at a time.
Great work. And I hope a lot of people log on and sign. I'll be interested to see what the next you're at. You said you're going to be adding to their 10 principles right now.
I would like to say one of them really fast because it comes from Paul Newman. Everyone, I think, is familiar with Newman's Own. And the last line of his obituary in the New York Times was him saying, I'm just saying that in life we need to be a little bit more like the farmer who puts back into the soil what he takes out. And that's the way somebody wanted to remember him, whoever wrote that obituary. And because of the iconic role that Newman's Own has played in giving away its profits, I just think that's, you know, it's not that complicated. It's a feeling. It's an idea that we just have to start treating business as different. Business has to serve people. people and places. It's not just a roulette machine to try to make money from. And I think the current crisis we're in, if we just come back from agriculture and just speak more globally about economics, I think we are at the end of a cycle. You know, the cycle may kick back in for another 5 years, 10 years, who knows? I'm not saying it's stopping tomorrow. But I think if you zoom back, you see that the end of this idea of that business exists to make money for distant shareholders, or that when we invest, we just invest in cyberspace, we let some intermediary put our money wherever it can make the highest risk, the highest return, lowest risk thing. We're at the end of that, and I think the power of slow money is the way of just getting people to start acting differently, you know, with small food enterprises that are down the street from them.
Woody Tash, I'd like to thank you for being here today. Again, Woody's book is Slow Money, Investing as a Food, Farms, and Fertility Mattered. It's published by Chelsea Green Publishing. You can visit www.chelseagreen.com or slowmoneyalliance.org to find a copy or also to sign the principles or at least get a better idea of what Woody's talking about here. Our sponsor today has been Hearst Ranch. We'd like to thank them very much. Edible Communities Radio will be back on Heritage Radio Network next week with your host, Deborah Shapiro, and of Edible Green Mountains. Thanks for joining us today.